The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm Denver Frederick, and I think you're really going to enjoy our first guest tonight. She's Deborah Borda, the president and CEO of the New York Philharmonic. She's back in the job that she held in the 1990s and before heading out west to lead the L.A. Phil for 17 years. But her history with the New York Philharmonic goes much further back than the last time she led it.
Well, actually, my first concert in those days, this is how old I am, the New York Philharmonic played at Carnegie Hall.
Yeah.
So my mother took me and to the concert, and I remember we sat at the very, very top. And as we climbed the stairs, because I was tiny,
yeah.
Each stair felt like it was, you know, 3 feet high.
Oh, said, climbing a mountain. Yeah.
And we finally got up to the top, and, you know, it was... I was there, and the concert started. And I only know it's Leonard Bernstein because I went back and checked. Because when I sat and I looked at it, I thought, I didn't know if there were real players on the stage because they looked about 1 inch high. So I thought maybe it was a toy orchestra.
And then I'll be joined by Elie Hassenfeld, the co-founder and executive director of GiveWell. When he couldn't find the proper guidance to make an informed decision on giving, he decided to do something about it and started GiveWell.
When we saw how little information was available, we found ourselves incredibly interested in this question of how can we give most effectively and frustrated that the information didn't exist. Americans collectively give more than $300 billion every year to charity. And we knew from personal experience that information to help guide those decisions wasn't available. And so we started GiveWell to be the resource that we were looking for when we were in the private sector.
But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, April 28th. The nation recycles less than 10% of its plastic. Now, that compares to 67% for paper materials, 34% for metals, and 26% for glass. And did you know that an aluminum can that is recycled can be back on a grocery store shelf within 60 days? Now, that's fast. Giving kids a lesson in how the junk food industry engineers food to be addictive and how it targets kids with ads is more effective in improving eating habits than simple nutritional lessons. That's exactly what worked for tobacco. And finally, in one of the newest Lego sets under development, the bumps that hold the toys together have a second purpose. They also help children learn Braille. The series of dots on each brick represents a different letter of the Braille alphabet, the numbers 0 through 9, and a handful of math symbols. And that is the Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back to speak with Deborah Borda of the New York Philharmonic right after this.
Technology can change lives, but underserved communities around the world have yet to experience all the benefits technology offers. Benetech is a nonprofit whose mission is to empower communities in need by creating scalable technology solutions. Learn more by visiting benetech.org. If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from The Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
Managing an arts institution in the 21st century, like the New York Philharmonic, is one of the most daunting challenges any leader could face, whether in the profit or nonprofit world. There are many who would say that there is absolutely no one better at doing this than my next guest. She led the New York Philharmonic in the 1990s, went out to California for 17 years to become the CEO of the L.A. Philharmonic, and is now back in New York for a second tour of duty. And it's a great pleasure to have her with us tonight. She is Deborah Borda, the president and CEO of the New York Philharmonic. Good evening, Deborah, and
Hi.
Welcome to the Business of Giving.
Hi, Denver. Great to be here.
The New York Philharmonic was founded in 1842, 177 years ago. I can't believe it is as old as the Vienna Philharmonic. Share with us a little bit of its rich history.
The New York Philharmonic, you know, it's fascinating. We talk about an orchestra being 177 years old. And, I mean, that's truly a landmark in American history. When the orchestra was founded, where was Wyoming? I still don't know. I do. But at any rate, and it was an orchestra of immigrants, which is a sort of fascinating part of the story, that as this city has benefited from wave after wave of immigration, that is who has filled out this orchestra. So it's a history of firsts. It was the first American orchestra to tour Europe. Mm-hmm. It was the first American orchestra to be on radio and TV. We had the first and most famous – well, he wasn't the first, but certainly the most famous American music director, Leonard Bernstein. And here's a factoid I love. It was the first American orchestra to allow women to attend concerts unaccompanied by a man.
Progress.
That's progress. It's slow, but it's happening. Yeah. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. So it's a rich history of firsts. But one of the things we like to think about here is that although we stand on the shoulders of what's occurred over the past 177 years, when you look at the history of a place this old, it has a lot of ups and a lot of downs. And that's quite natural for a 177-year-old thing, mm-hmm. institution. But what you notice is that when the Philharmonic truly flourishes, it's when it dares to be innovative. Oh. It's when it dares to be a leader. And that is something that we work hard to inculcate into the and renew in the fabric of the DNA of this organization. Because it's wonderful we did all of those things, but what we need to think about is what we're going to do in the future.
Absolutely. Wasn't it a hard decision for you to make, Deborah, to leave Los Angeles after you had built that institution the way you had over 17 years and really on the eve of their centennial, which is being celebrated this year, to come back to New York and a whole new set of challenges? And what compelled you to make that decision?
Probably that I'm a masochist. You know, when I first went out to Los Angeles, I thought I would go out, help to get the orchestra back on its feet because it was in a very rocky and parlous financial state, but critically to get Walt Disney Concert Hall built and opened. So I thought that was my goal, and partly because I was discouraged about achieving that goal here in the renovation of what was then called Avery Fisher Hall. So I planned to go out for 5 years. I loaded up my covered wagon, and I went out there. And, you know, there was a lot of work to do, and I thought that we were accomplishing work that was important for music and important for thinking about how we think about music in the 21st century, what is the impact of social issues and social justice in music. It was a remarkable time working with Esa-Pekka Salonen and Frank Gehry. It was a very tight trio as we opened Walt Disney Concert Hall and really reimagined what the orchestra could be using the Walt Disney Concert Hall as a launching pad. When it broke my heart that Esa-Pekka moved on, but he had been there for longer than any other music director of the Los Angeles Philharmonic, we were fortuitous in being able to discover this 25-year-old guy, Gustavo Dudamel, and he inspired me. It's very inspiring to work with people who are younger than you are and come from a different society and social background. And so there it was, you know, it'd been the Esa-Pekka, the opening of Walt Disney Concert Hall, my partnership with Frank Gehry, and then this guy, Gustavo Dudamel, comes into my life. And it was exciting, and it was a whole fresh series of opportunities. But after I had been there 17 years and taken the we had been very involved in planning. I had been deeply involved in planning the centennial. So it was planned. Mm-hmm. I started to think about was I bringing the kind of freshness to the job that I needed to? And could, in fact, the institution, after 17 years, benefit from new leadership? Mm-hmm. I was thinking about it. It was in the back of my mind. I took a sabbatical and I taught at the Kennedy School. And during that time, I felt myself expand intellectually and socially in so many different ways. I thought, I felt more and more it was going to be a good thing for me to make a change. And then out of the blue, the New York Philharmonic came back into my life. And there you have it.
Well, picking up on that expansion, I mean, since 20 years ago when you sat in this very same chair— society has changed. New York has changed. But how have you changed in the way you lead an institution like the New York Philharmonic?
The way we learn to manage from our mentors and back in the 80s was extremely top-down. And it put a lot of pressure on the chief executive. Because what you needed to do was sit with your senior management group and sort of opine on, they would present a problem and you would present the solution. And if you're pretty smart, you can do well at that for a while. But as the world and these institutions became increasingly complex, I found it more and more of a challenge. And there was a period about 10 years ago when I felt like I really wasn't a very good manager. My management skills just weren't clicking in the way that I wanted them to. And I started thinking about it, and I realized that, in a sense, there are so many different areas that require expertise now. There are different ways of asking questions that I needed to work with my team in a different kind of way. And so, in a sense, I think I took the pressure off myself.
Yeah.
I didn't feel like I had to have all the answers and I was somehow not a good manager or a good person. Yeah, it does wear you out. And once I really invested complete responsibility with the other people I was working closely with, a tremendous burden was taken off me and we put it on them. But actually, they thrived and the institution thrived. So I think the management skills today that we employ are so different, partly in reaction to much more complex societal situation. I mean, just take the invention of – well, not the invention, the internet and what social media means and how you deal with that, changing audiences. How we manage our endowment plans, how we deal with union employees, so many different areas. And so I've changed a lot, and I'm not the same person who managed the New York Philharmonic almost 20 years ago.
Well,
I'm a different person.
Yeah, you've reinvented yourself for the times.
I hope.
You know, my impression in speaking to people from Los Angeles is that they're a bit more open and adventurous out there than they are here in New York. Would that be true, would you say, for the Philharmonic and their audiences?
Actually, I've been pleasantly surprised.
Good.
One thing I will say in California is people never just say no. Mm-hmm. They say, well, let's think about that. So no idea is too crazy. For example, the idea of how we introduced and opened Walt Disney Concert Hall would have seemed like a far-out idea, inviting 18,000 people in for free from different segments of the community. And it turned out nobody said no, and we did it. And it meant that Walt Disney Concert Hall found a real place in the heart of Angelenos. So I was concerned about that when I came back to the East Coast, but I'm a New Yorker.
Yeah.
So I can handle a certain amount of adversity, a certain amount of pushback. But I found it to be a very different institution, and an institution that is looking for a new way, that is, yes, aware of its tradition, but I think increasingly thinking about how that tradition and culture doesn't weigh us down, but in fact propels us into the future.
Interesting. Let's talk about a couple of the conductors you've worked with. Gustavo Dudamel, we talked about in Los Angeles, and Jaap van Weyden here in New York. Boy, it's amazing you were able to land both of them. Try to describe their outstanding characteristic, both as conductors and as people.
Well, let's start with Jaap.
Yep.
Because that's who I'm working with right now. And in fact, I didn't land him. I didn't hire him. He was here.
Right.
And he, in fact, was one of the key players in convincing me.
Recruiting you, right.
Yes, that it would be a... could be fun to come back to New York. And I had always thought, I will say in the back of my mind, I'm a New Yorker. I always thought at some point I would return to New York. Jaap became concertmaster of one of the most famous orchestras in the world, the Concertgebouw. He went to Juilliard, although he's Dutch, went back and became concertmaster, I think at some insane age. He was wunderkind. I think he was 19, something like that. Something like that. And he played in that orchestra. And what that has given him is a remarkable sense of being able to speak to an orchestra and help them in the actual mechanics and putting together of a concert. He can listen. He understands balances. He can tell the instruments, very technical kinds of things they have to do, strings up bow, you know, horns blend your sound like this. So it's remarkable to hear that. And he has a click with an orchestra really almost unlike anything I've ever seen.
Interesting.
And you can hear the difference today in how the Philharmonic sounds. The other part of Yap that was unexpected for New York, I understood it, but people didn't see it here. There was a lot of consternation that he was going to be very right-wing and conservative. He, in fact, had run one of the famous Dutch radio orchestras, and these are orchestras that perform almost completely contemporary music. So as I got to know him, I was amazed. He knows as much about American contemporary music as I do, and I think I know a lot about it. He knows more. And he's been a fabulous partner in terms of thinking about how we shape the season, how we try to catch the zeitgeist of our times and the pillars that we call these special initiatives that we undertake. So for me, the combination of just such a master of the symphonic art form and a deeply knowledgeable and adventurous programmer has been just terrific. And he's a lot of fun. He's he's very straightforward. Uh-huh. He's very Dutch.
Yeah.
And I'm a New Yorker. Uh-huh. And didn't the Dutch found New York?
There you go. And a great teacher, too.
Well,
it sounds like.
All conductors have to do a couple of things. One is they have to teach.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is they have to inspire.
Yeah.
And both of those are critical. And you can't succeed if you do one without the other. You must be able to teach, but you must be able to inspire as well. If you just inspire, it can be a mess. If you just teach, it can be boring. So we like to get a few other things going in there, which he does.
And far as Gustavo?
Well, Gustavo, let me tell you how I first heard about Gustavo. I received a phone call from our then music director, Esa-Pekka Salonen, late one afternoon. He was a judge at the Mahler competition, the International Mahler competition. And he called me from Bamberg, Germany, and he said, "Deborah, you won't believe what just happened. This 24-year-old Venezuelan kid just won the Mahler competition. He doesn't speak German, he doesn't speak English, and he just conducted the best damn Mahler 5 I have ever heard in my life." So I said, "Wow, what's his name?" So I then heard the words Gustavo Dudamel for the first time. So I said, "Well, Esa-Pekka, you know, how good is he really?" And he goes, "Well, here's what I'm going to tell you. He's just a conducting animal." So the next thing I thought about was, well, let's get him out to L.A. Because, you know, I did – Esa-Pekka and I had such a close relationship that we were able – you know, we moved on things rather quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So the next day I called to book concerts with Gustavo Dudamel, and he didn't have a manager. There was no place to call. So the next day after that, I went back at it, and he had 5 managers. And then a day later, he had his manager who has been with him ever since, actually. So he came to L.A., and it was simply spontaneous combustion with the orchestra. There is a special spirit, a special love of music, and something I can't put into words that's unique about Gustavo. He's been conducting since he was 11 years old. He was the wunderkind of El Sistema and maestro José Antonio Abreu, who founded El Sistema. Mm-hmm. And to see his development, because he was great to begin with, but to see his development, you know, over this past decade has been truly spectacular. And, you know, you talk about learning things. Gustavo said something to me that has always stayed with me, and it's like a motto. And what he said is, music is a fundamental human right.
Hmm.
Music is a fundamental human right. What a thought. It's a fundamental human right is clean air, water, education. But he sees it as that central, and that was such an inspiration to me.
Yeah, I've never heard that before. Yeah. That really is.
And so this funny story. I couldn't get him to sign a contract to be music director. Every orchestra in the world was chasing after him, actually the New York Philharmonic, the Chicago Symphony. So I followed him around the world, and he, of course, tells the story much better than I do, but he decided – first he thought I was a stalker, and then he decided I was just I had a crush on him. Now, I am old enough to be his mother, but he thought maybe.
You never know.
Eventually, I went to Venezuela
mm-hmm.
and spent a week with him traveling around the country and seeing El Sistema in action. And El Sistema, for your listeners who don't know, is a music education program that goes into the very poorest neighborhoods and trains kids in music. There are orchestras, or were orchestras, it's very sad, all over Venezuela. Kids teach each other. It's, you know, and the most famous of the orchestras was the Simon Bolivar Orchestra, which was a spectacular orchestra. So at the end of my week there, and I literally, I heard orchestras with hundreds of kids in small little towns in the poorest barrios. When I got on the plane to go back to Los Angeles, I still couldn't get him to sign the contract. But I made a vow to myself right then that if I couldn't get Gustavo Dudamel to come to Los Angeles, I would bring El Sistema to Los Angeles. And we did that before.
Like no one else.
Yeah, yeah. It's a great program. We don't call it El Sistema because we needed to adjust it for America.
Mm-hmm.
And the great thing about El Sistema is it's flexible. It can work in Scotland. It can work in Los Angeles. But it can only work if it works within the fabric of the community that it is placed. And I think that's an important lesson, actually, when you think about what we're going to do here in a very exciting future in the New York Philharmonic, because what works in Los Angeles or what works in Chicago or what works in Edinburgh may not necessarily work in New York. And so our job is to be the pathfinders in our own city. And so our little mantra here is in our city, in our time, because that is the unique job of the New York Philharmonic in New York in 2019 and beyond.
Absolutely. You were one of the first women to be a CEO of a major orchestra, and now quite a number of women are leading major arts organizations such as Deborah Rutter and here Katie Clark over at BAM in New York. But progress has been slower with conductors. Picking up on conductors again, although I think some progress has been made and you are doing a lot to see that it continues and accelerates, why do you think progress has been slower there and what are some of the initiatives to get more women leading orchestras?
Well, there have been tremendous breakthroughs and we're on the verge of even more. I think it's a complicated question, but it has to do with the misogyny and sexism in society. You know, when you're a little girl and you get on an airplane and you say to your grandmother, you see the pilot get on, you say, oh, I'd like to be a pilot. And that mother or grandmother says to their daughter, no, you can be a flight attendant.
Right. That's what happened to you.
Yeah, exactly. My story. I went to the doctor and I told my family, I'd like to be a doctor. And they said, you can be a nurse. So I became an orchestra manager. So I think there is that inherent sexism and misogyny, which people have to work to overcome. And it relates very specifically to symphony orchestras for two reasons. One is, remember that until 10 or 15 years ago, orchestras were entirely male.
Yep.
And they really didn't have gender equality or a move towards it until the late 60s when auditions behind screens were introduced. So if a woman got up in front of the orchestra, she would be perhaps the only woman there. There might be one other. And that was, I think, a difficult situation. But I think there's actually a more profound reason, which is that if you don't see somebody do something, you can't always imagine yourself in that role. Some of us can imagine we could be jet pilots, but not everybody can. And once it started being introduced that people could come to concerts and see women conduct, I think women, younger women, started to imagine their physicality in different ways. Because remember, conducting is a very physical business. There's a physicality. And the epitome of conducting is a male.
Yeah.
But we can't – that's not our physicality as women. We have to find our own way. And this younger group of people has been able to imagine that and feel very comfortable in this new physicality. And they're wonderful to watch on the podium because they don't conduct like men.
Right.
They conduct – like they conduct.
Yeah. With the progress that is being made there, it's come a little bit slower with diversity. Because when you go to these concerts, you know, 90% of the people in the audience are going to be white. Most of the faces on stage are going to be white. What has to happen to change that?
This is a real issue, and it takes a long time. In Los Angeles, the idea behind YOLA wasn't to...
And YOLA is?
YOLA is youth... I'm sorry. YOLA is Youth Orchestra LA, which is the El Sistema of Los Angeles. The idea behind Youth Orchestra LA or El Sistema Los Angeles was to involve hundreds of kids and their families, not to train them to be musicians, although some of them became wonderful musicians and are becoming wonderful musicians, but to train them to be great teachers or firemen or doctors, but to have a love of music. So later on in life, and these are all from minority communities. YOLA was, I should say this, I didn't say it at the beginning, YOLA Youth Orchestra LA, which is a series of music schools throughout Los Angeles, is all based in minority communities. You know, we don't have a YOLA LA. We don't have a YOLA Beverly Hills is what I'm trying to say. There is a YOLA LA. So it's thinking about things in that way, and that kind of change takes a long time. The other thing that we've learned is, and you can see, by the way, in Los Angeles that audiences are starting to change. Also, to have a Latino who is the head of the music program,
that's right.
Gustavo Dudamel, your music director, that also makes an impression, although it didn't happen overnight. It absolutely didn't happen overnight. So change will be evolutionary. I personally believe that what is going to need to happen to make a difference is you can't simply hope to take one minority, place them in an orchestra, and think that they can succeed in a training program. Research has shown us that you need a nucleus of people to support each other, to interact, to fit within the organization. So my hope is that in the future, the major American orchestras are going to undertake massive fellowship programs where, you know, 10 people are welcomed into the orchestra for a period of a number of years, 2 or 3 years. And maybe they'll eventually win a place in the Chicago Symphony, the New York Philharmonic, or another orchestra. But I think that is the way we're going to have to go at it, because the way we're going at it now simply isn't working. And we have to admit that.
Yeah. You come from a very active politically household you grew up in, and that trip you talked about a few moments ago to Venezuela really had an impact on you in joining at the intersection of the artistic and the social. And you are certainly doing a lot of that here in New York right now. Tell us about the Pillars program and some of the other things that you're doing.
When you think about a New York Philharmonic season, we start in September and we chug along until June, doing 4 concerts a week, most weeks out of the year. And you need to, first of all, give a shape to that. You can't just do isolated, you know, 1 week Beethoven symphony, next week a Brahms symphony, next week a Mahler symphony, et cetera. It doesn't, I believe, hold together. But there's another issue, which is we have to find a way to attract millennials to attend our concerts and to interest them. And many of them have not had any music education. But they are interested in social events, social causes. And I felt, and Jaap felt, that if we could take some of our concerts and place them within the context of what is the zeitgeist of the times, and put them in a broader cultural milieu, that we could start to bring in audiences who might not otherwise have thought about coming to the Philharmonic. So this year, I'll talk about just 2 of our pillars. We call them pillars. Right. They're really initiatives. Pillars is just a shorthand for it. The first, which has already taken place, was called New York City Stories, Threads of Our City. And we centered it on the world premiere of a piece by a remarkable woman composer, Julia Wolf. And it was a piece about the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire and how 147 young immigrants of all different backgrounds were incinerated, you know, in the course of 8 minutes. Very moving piece. It had video. It had choirs. It was really something. But that wasn't enough. So what we did was to partner with other institutions, Museum of the City of New York, the Tenement Museum, Ellis Island, etc., and to open a discussion about what has immigration meant to the city of New York? What has truly shaped the vibrancy and robust nature of our society, of New Yorkers? And it was a fascinating discussion held all over the city. And I believe that that really caught people's imagination, especially right now as we're talking about shutting down the Mexican border, not allowing, you know, regular immigration to happen, which has so strengthened our nation. And the proof of this was in the final night of this very contemporary piece. Actually, in the final nights, you could not get a ticket. People were standing outside David Geffen Hall saying, anybody got a ticket? Now, we'll close the season with something called Music of Conscience. Mm-hmm. That'll be our final pillar. And this initiative is about music that has been written in response to times of social turmoil. We will bring back, we did the New York premiere of John Corigliano's First Symphony. It's called Of Rage and Remembrance. In 1 2-month period at the height of the AIDS epidemic, he lost 8 friends and wrote this work. We did the premiere, as I said, the New York premiere, actually, at the Philharmonic back in the 90s. And when we did it, we had heard about this project called the Quilt Project, where people were doing quilt squares for people they had lost. So we got a quilt square from the project. It had to be a certain size.
Mm-hmm.
And we put it up in the front of what was then Avery Fisher Hall. And we invited people to sign. We didn't know what would happen. I was backstage before the concert. And our house manager came to get me and said, Deborah, you have to come out in front and see what's happening. I said, I'm busy back here. He said, no, please come out in front with me. So I walked to the front of the hall, and there was a line snaking around the entire hall. And, you know, this was everybody. Everybody had lost somebody.
Yes.
And or knew somebody. And at the end of the first night, the panel was completely filled. Mm. And we had a fresh one for every single night. And we'll bring that panel back, and one of the original panels for people to see. But we're also partnering with a number of other organizations like Gay Men's Health Crisis, et cetera, to look back at the history of what did the response to the AIDS epidemic mean, and how did it change our nation and the face of our artistic institutions, our academic institutions, our lives. We'll end the season with an opera that we've commissioned called Prisoner of the State by wonderful American composer David Lang. And this is – Beethoven wrote a single opera, Fidelio. And it's, of course, about an authoritarian and a tyrant who unjustly imprisons an activist, and how his wife eventually gets him freed. And so this is a 21st century take on Fidelio, Prisoner of the State, and I think a fascinating commentary to think about in this very tumultuous political time. And we'll open up with, of course, a standard of social protest, Beethoven's Eroica.
Mm-hmm.
Was supposed to be dedicated to Napoleon, but then he decided
– He turned on him, right?
He was a creep, and he was.
Yeah, you figured that out.
So, and we'll pair that with Shostakovich's Chamber Symphony, which is a fascinating work. Lady Macbeth of Minsk, Shostakovich opera, was a tremendous success. A couple of days after it opened, there was an editorial in Pravda, and people believed that Stalin himself had written this editorial and had said that this was a horrible piece of music. It was a crime against the state, and the composer had better be careful because he was about to be sent to Siberia, basically.
Whatever it is,
So Shostakovich went to his apartment and basically stayed there for a month in terror. And during that time, he composed the Chamber Symphony. And what you can actually hear in the Chamber Symphony is his fear of the KGB coming and knocking at his door. So there's a moment that keeps coming back in the orchestra. You hear clunk, clunk, clunk. The strings make this funny sound. And it's his fear, his writing out and giving actualization to this fear that he was about to be taken to Siberia. He was not, thank goodness. So I think placing things in that context, it's interesting, it's timely, and it makes music, as we say, a human right.
Yeah, yeah. Just great stuff, Deborah. You know, in addition to putting all this music in that social context, you're also trying to make this music more accessible. And one initiative to do that is something called Phil Hall.
Now, Phil the Hall.
Phil the Hall, that's right.
It's a joke. P-H-I-L is in Philharmonic.
Describe that program for us.
Well, there are so many New Yorkers who haven't been invited into the hall. Many people who invite themselves and buy tickets, and that's great. But what we wanted to do was to invite people who might not think about coming into the hall. And who we wanted to invite are the people who serve New York, firemen, teachers, the workers at Lincoln Center. And so we have put on, instead of – we were actually – during this period, we were supposed to be on a national tour. And Yap and I decided, okay, let's not do this national tour. The Philharmonic tours all over the world. We don't need yet another national tour. Let's have a tour at home. Let's stay here. And let's invite these New Yorkers into our concerts. Every ticket is $5,
mm-hmm.
and the place is going to be packed. They're one-hour concerts,
Perfect.
1 hour concerts. So they introduce people, and it's got Gershwin, it's got Beethoven, it's got two of our, we have a wonderful program for very young composers. And these kids are incredibly talented, and they've written little three-minute pieces. And just to sort of welcome people, we've invited wonderful musician and music teacher, Nia Franklin, who is Miss America, and she is going to be the host. And so we're currently debating on whether she'll wear her crown or not.
And you don't have to make that decision by yourself with your new leadership style.
That is right. I can tell you it's a very hot topic. We'll probably take a vote this afternoon.
All righty.
I think the crown's cool, but, you know, who knows?
I hope they're not listening to this. We don't want to influence anybody. You know, making the finances of these venerable institutions work is such a difficult thing to do. You certainly, as you said before, stepped into a challenging circumstances at the L.A. Philharmonic. I think they were into the banks about $9 million when you arrived. And these challenges continue to go on. What's your approach to managing finances of an arts institution like the New York Philharmonic?
Well, it's not rocket science.
Yeah.
It's pretty straightforward. But one of the places you have to start is that even if we sell out David Geffen Hall, or if you sold out Walt Disney Concert Hall, that covers only about half of the cost of putting on a concert. Why is it so expensive, you might ask? Well, we have the orchestra salaries, we have the staff salaries, we give health care and benefits to the people who work for us. You have to sell tickets, you have to market the orchestra, you have to produce the concerts. And, you know, you can only sell about, you know, 2,000 or so seats, and you don't want to charge $500 a ticket because it's simply too expensive. Mm-hmm. You have to have some responsibility in that. So we are genuinely a not-for-profit organization. When we're doing great, we're losing money. And so you have to think of it, first of all, in that context and really educate your board, you know, to understand that. Because the future of the orchestras will not be in earning more money. It will be in philanthropy. But I think in addition to that, the next step is to really build a vision that the institution shares and moves towards. And when people share a vision, they're inspired by it, they move towards it, you can then put the kind of mechanics in place that can raise the money that you need. Now, there's a lot of footwork. You know, raising money is not just that you go have lunch with some rich person and they give you money. There's all sorts of – there are annual funds and bequests and endowment drives. And so you've got to work at the technical side of that. And in fact, when I was teaching at the Kennedy School, I taught a course called Philanthropy 101, which was to help people think about how they organize the technical side of it. But people won't give to an organization they don't believe in.
Mm-hmm.
And isn't that the critical question?
Yeah, absolutely. Let me close with this, Deborah. You know, they talk about coming home again, and coming back to the New York Philharmonic for you is really coming home again, in that your first concert was here when you were 4 years old. Leonard Bernstein was conducting, which I must say was a pretty good way to start. What has music meant to you and, in turn, this institution?
Well, actually, my first concert in those days, this is how old I am, the New York Philharmonic played at Carnegie Hall.
Yeah.
So my mother took me and to the concert, and I remember we sat at the very, very top. And as we climbed the stairs, because I was tiny,
yeah.
Each stair felt like it was, you know, 3 feet high.
Oh, said, climbing a mountain.
Yeah. And we finally got up to the top, and, you know, I was there, and the concert started. And I only know it's Leonard Bernstein because I went back and checked. Because when I sat and I looked at it, I thought, I didn't know if there were real players on the stage because they looked about 1 inch high. So I thought maybe it was a toy orchestra. But I loved the sound. And, of course, the sound is great at the top of Carnegie Hall. And I was hooked. I loved it. And my parents listened to the classical music station in New York, WQXR. I always wanted to have that on. And then I had a little, you know, one of those little tiny records that kids used to play. What are they called? The little small ones, you know. And I had an arrangement of the Eine kleine Nachtmusik by Mozart. And I listened to that until I wore it out. Mm-hmm. As soon as I could play an instrument, you know, I wanted to take one. Violin, yeah. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to play the violin. I wanted to play the flute. But you had to get in line at school to claim your instrument. And by the time I got there, all the flutes were gone, and there were two choices, violin or French horn, and I thought the violin would be easier to carry.
Yeah.
So there we have it. But music, it's hard. I can't put into words what it means to me. It's just so I couldn't imagine my life without it.
Yeah.
I listen to music all the time.
You
I go to concerts
yourself
all the
a
time.
Musician. Although yes, I you're am. A music administrator.
No, I am a musician.
Yeah, yeah, right.
I am a musician. I don't play anymore because I don't have enough time to practice, but I can look at a score or look at a conductor or listen to a soloist and give you a pretty informed opinion. And I am just so grateful I have music in my life. And I can't imagine my life without it.
Or this institution, I guess.
Well, this institution is about music.
Well, Deborah Borda, the president and CEO of the New York Philharmonic, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. There is always something going on up here. Where do people go for tickets, upcoming events, fill the hall, maybe become a member?
Well, we've got a great website. You can just go right on the internet and just you don't even have to do anything but type in New York Philharmonic. It'll pop up. And there are tickets available for concerts at all different prices. During the summer, we give free concerts throughout the boroughs, and of course, our most famous one is the big Central Park concert, where we'll have over 50,000 people on the Great Lawn. And you can go on our website because I am not remembering the day in July that that's happening, but that's always a great New York event.
Well, fantastic! Thanks, Deborah. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program,
Denver. Thank you so much.
I'll be back with more of the Business of Giving right after this.
Most teachers spend over $500 of their own money every year on school supplies because classrooms lack books, art supplies, even pencils. At DonorsChoose.org, you can help schools get the resources they need most. Bring a classroom dream to life. Visit DonorsChoose.org. Follow the Business of Giving on Twitter at BizOfGive and at Facebook.com/BusinessOfGiving. And now, back to the Business of Giving with your host, Denver Frederick, on AM 970, The Answer.
Can you help me remember how to smile?
So suppose you made some money and wanted to make a contribution to a nonprofit organization where that donation would have the greatest impact to improve people's lives. Where would you begin to look for that information? Well, that is a dilemma that faced my next guest, and all he did is start an organization to help answer that very question. He is Elliot Hassenfeld, the co-founder and executive director of GiveWell. Good evening, Elliot, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
So you started GiveWell to address this gap in the market that you and your co-founder had identified. Share that story with us, if you would.
We went to work at a hedge fund right after graduating college. And after being there for a couple of years, we wanted to give to charity. We had made enough money that we had some savings, and we wanted to give a little back. We wanted to bring the same type of analytical approach to charitable giving that we did in our work lives, that we had in our making other decisions. And we thought we'd be able to go out and get great information about what charities do and how well they work. When we went to look for that information, we found that there was almost nothing available. There was information that said, how much do CEOs make or how much charities spend on administrative expenses versus their programs? But that didn't tell us how well the programs were working. So just to give one example, if you imagine a charity that digs wells in Africa, if it spends all its money digging wells, but then the wells fall apart the next year, it hasn't accomplished any good. When we saw how little information was available, we found ourselves incredibly interested in this question of how can we give most effectively and frustrated that the information didn't exist. Americans collectively give more than $300 billion every year to charity. And we knew from personal experience that information to help guide those decisions wasn't available. And so we started GiveWell to be the resource that we were looking for when we were in the private sector.
Yeah. And not only did you identify a need, you really liked doing this, didn't you?
Oh, I mean, when I was working in finance, I loved my job, but I was never up on the weekends reading about the bond market.
Yeah, right. I bet.
And all of a sudden, it's Saturday night at 3 a.m. and I'm reading papers about diarrhea in Africa, which is one of the leading causes of child mortality.
Right.
And at that point, I knew that this might be something that we should try to turn into a career.
Well, you have four criteria, Ellie, that you examine for evaluating organizations. Share with us what those are.
So in brief, those criteria are evidence of effectiveness, cost effectiveness, what we call room for more funding, and then transparency. And I'll just go through those each one by one.
Please do.
For evidence of effectiveness, our question is, what impact does this program have on people's lives? There's a lot of programs that we see around us. They can be educational programs, job training programs. And the question is, what effect do these programs have on the outcomes of the people who go through them? And shockingly, very few of these programs have been carefully evaluated to show what impacts they have. We look for programs that have been rigorously evaluated, often, though not always, with randomized controlled trials. And this is the standard of evidence used in medicine,
right,
where you take a group of people and you randomly divide them into two. You give some the program and some you don't give others the program. And then the only difference between the two groups should be whether or not they received the program, allowing you to figure out whether or not the program is effective. And because many programs have not been studied, or when they have, they're found to be ineffective, we look for programs that can demonstrate via this rigorous evidence that they're having an effect. So, for example, one of the programs we support is malaria net distribution to protect against the mosquitoes that transmit malaria in Africa. Mm-hmm. And this program has been studied through more than 20 randomized controlled trials that demonstrate when you give out nets, people use them, it reduces cases of malaria and saves children lives. And that is the exception rather than the rule for most charitable endeavors. Our second criterion is cost effectiveness. And that is very simple. We just want to maximize the impact that our dollars have. We would prefer to give to an organization that can save someone's life for $2,500 than to give to an organization that costs $25,000 mm-hmm. to accomplish the same goal. And so therefore, we are looking carefully at making that type of assessment. Our third criterion, which we call room for more funding, is trying to understand what an organization would do with the additional donations that it receives. Organizations often have funding in hand that they can put to use, but what a donor cares about is what they will do with the additional money that they give to the organization.
Give us an example of an organization that's doing great work but doesn't really have a need for additional funding.
Yeah, so I think a common charitable program that people know about is performing surgeries in low-income countries.
Yep.
And in order to perform surgeries, obviously, a charity needs to have surgeons that it can pay to go and perform surgeries. In many low-income countries, the supply of surgeons is constrained. A charity could invest in training, educating,
right.
That's a very long run, difficult process. But a charity may not be able to use its funds to pay for more surgeries if the supply of surgeons is constrained. Another way in which this criterion plays into our analysis is an organization might be choosing to go into a country with lower rates of a disease. And so if the malaria rate in one country is much higher than it is in another country, its malaria-focused program will be more cost-effective. And then finally, our last criterion is transparency, which just means that organizations need to be ready and willing to share information with us. The vast majority of information about charitable organizations is not public, and therefore we can't do our research if organizations don't want to share substantive information.
And having used this filter, you ended up by really focusing exclusively on global health and development. Why was that the case?
The thing that philanthropists, people giving charity, can bring that others don't have is their money. That's mm-hmm. what we're giving. And the biggest difference between overseas and places closer to home is the difference in how much money is available to the people who need it. So there is poverty. There is significant poverty here in the U.S., but we focus overseas because of how much greater the need is there. So kids die overseas for lack of access to basic medicines like antibiotics to treat pneumonia. People don't have basic nutrition. And because a dollar goes so much further overseas, we've chosen to focus in those regions.
Well, give us an example of one. Why don't we take the Malaria Consortium and walk us through the process that you went through with them and what made them so exceptional that they have made your list of recommendations?
They're an organization that implements a program called Seasonal Malaria Chemo Prevention. And that's a long name, but what it means is that they give preventative malaria treatment to children under five during the 4 months of the year when malaria is most prevalent in the areas that they focus on in northern Africa. And by this program was studied through multiple randomized controlled trials, which show that when you give treatments to children, it prevents cases of malaria and averts deaths that they otherwise would have had from malaria. So the first step in our process was identifying and reviewing that evidence mm-hmm. and seeing that this program had a substantial effect. These treatments are very cheap. It costs approximately $5 to deliver the treatment and then monitor it after the fact to determine that it has been effectively delivered. And all in, this organization, it cost this organization approximately $2,500 to avert the death of a child. And the reason it cost $5 to deliver a treatment and $2,500 to avert a death is that most children who get malaria don't die, mm-hmm. but it is such a prevalent disease that so many people do eventually get malaria and then some portion of them die. And so it's a very cost-effective way to save people's lives.
Let me ask you the apple and orange question. And taking the malaria consortium and saving a person's life, which can be the ultimate result of helping support them, how do you compare that with an organization like GiveDirectly, which gives direct cash transfers to help a family raise their standard of living? How do you look at that?
So we try to compare these two things directly, and we recognize that we're trying to direct money to two very different types of outcomes. And we have to make the best judgment we can about how to weigh an increase in income against a reduction in mortality.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we are going out and we're trying to ask, we've funded some research where a research group goes out and it asks people in the countries that we're serving, how would you trade off between some increase in income and some improvement in health? And we want to incorporate that into our research process. But ultimately, if you only have $1,000 to give, you have to make a choice about how to trade off between these two values. And our goal in our research is to make the information about what choices donors are making publicly available so that anyone can make this choice for themselves about how they trade off between these two potential outcomes.
One of the things I love about GiveWell is that you just don't only collect this information, but you really go out there and make some very specific recommendations on organizations that make an awful lot of sense for donors to fund. Just give us a couple of the others.
We recommend another malaria organization called the Against Malaria Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
They distribute malaria nets to protect against the mosquitoes that transmit malaria. We recommend four organizations, all of which focus on an area called deworming, which is treating children for parasitic infections. We recommend a program that Helen Keller International runs focused on vitamin A supplementation. Some children in low-income countries have very high rates of vitamin A deficiency, and there is very strong evidence that giving children under five supplements on a either annual or semi-annual basis significantly reduces child mortality. And then finally, we recommend GiveDirectly. It's an organization that just hands out cash and lets people decide for themselves about where they can put it to the best use.
You also have an incubation program where you help fund startup organizations who might one day make the GiveWell recommended list. Tell us how that works and tell us some of the organizations that you help seed.
So the idea there is that GiveWell starts by saying to an organization, what is your track record? What is your evidence? Can you already demonstrate that your program works? And organizations need funding to get to the point where they can demonstrate that their program works. They need funding to start up. They need funding to demonstrate, to gather evidence and complete monitoring. And so we want to support outstanding opportunities where there are organizations that are close to becoming a top charity,
mm-hmm.
could be a top charity, but don't have that funding along the way. One organization we supported is called New Incentives. They provide conditional cash transfers to families in Nigeria to encourage them to come and follow the basic immunization schedule. These are areas of Nigeria where the current immunization rates are very low, and the notion is that a small cash transfer could incentivize families to bring their children in when they should to get the immunizations that they need. We don't know whether or not this program will work, and so in combination with our giving this organization startup funding to run its operations, we've also directed funding to it and a research organization to evaluate how well this is working or if it is working at all,
mm-hmm.
via a randomized controlled trial. And we expect those results sometime next year, and then we'll be able to make a decision whether to recommend further funding to them.
Very cool. You're based in San Francisco. Describe the corporate culture and what it's like to work at GiveWell, and what do you think makes it exceptional and a distinctive place to show up every morning?
Three of the values that I think GiveWell holds that are different than other places and force us to make some difficult trade-offs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we are a place that really values openness first. You know, we are kind to each other. We care about each other. But we are trying to do something very difficult. And that requires a certain level of openness about what we need to do, what's going well, what's going poorly, so we can succeed and improve.
Any particular way that manifests itself or any kind of procedure or process that openness is almost baked into the culture?
Yeah, we have we use Slack as our internal chat program, and we have a channel for mistakes. If someone makes a mistake, they go in there and they say, I screwed up. I did this thing wrong. I recently sent out an email to a big donor with a typo in it. Not a catastrophic mistake, but certainly a mistake. And we celebrate those because we want people to understand that everyone makes mistakes. We know we do. Let's be open about that fact and then learn how to improve.
Oh, I can feel the peer pressure already of getting to Slack and announcing my mistake before somebody else finds it out.
Yeah, definitely. I think a second core tenet of ours is that we're truth-seeking. You know, ultimately, the core goal of what we do is trying to get better answers than already exist. And we believe that through hard work and deliberate thought, we can get better answers about how to help improve lives of people in other countries as much as possible. And that's really an overriding drive for people at GiveWell is this interest in getting the right answer or a better answer to questions. And I shouldn't say the right answer because the questions don't have right answers in the way that math problems do. But we can get better answers.
Never satisfied with the answer you currently have and always be looking to get it better.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then finally, you know, we are trying to maximize the impact that we have on beneficiaries. You know, what we are trying to do is improve the lives of people in low-income countries as much as possible. And that's the, you know, an overriding goal of ours. And the way in which that interacts with our other values is we sometimes say we don't know the answer and we're not going to try to get a better answer because it won't make a difference to what we do.
Mm-hmm.
And we are responsible for allocating a significant amount of money every year. And if we need to do that as well as possible, and we can't be distracted by interesting academic questions that won't actually matter to anyone's lives.
And speaking about openness, you actually take recordings of your board meetings and put them online?
We want to be an example to the nonprofit sector.
That's a great example.
We're not, you know, in the for-profit sector, companies are in competition with each other.
Mm-hmm.
In the nonprofit sector, we're not in competition with anyone. We are working together. If someone could create a better GiveWell and do our job better than we do, we should go out of business. That would be great. That wouldn't be bad. And so we want to put as much information out there in public to both help other organizations be more effective, but also to demonstrate that transparency is a better way for the nonprofit sector to operate because it will make it easier for all of us to accomplish our goals more effectively.
Couldn't agree with you more. Let me close with this, Ellie. You know, having examined so many organizations and in such depth, what two or three steps would you encourage nonprofits to take to become better and to become more effective?
I'll give you three things that come to mind that I think not every organization does as well as it should. The first is, what gap are you filling? Are you redundant with another organization, or do you have a unique value added to bring to the world? Too many people think, I have a great idea, I see a problem, I should go start an organization instead of just supporting the organizations that already exist.
You're exactly right.
The second is, do you know if you would fail? Too many organizations start things and do things without ever having a mechanism for figuring out whether or not what they're doing is actually working. And the question we ask when we look at all of the monitoring reports we see from charitable organizations is, if this program had been a disaster, if it had failed, would they have known? Or was the evaluation set up only to find success?
Mm-hmm.
If you want to improve, the only way to do it is to be able to identify failure and then move in a better direction. And I think the best things that we have done internally at GiveWell is set up processes for identifying problems and then moving in a better direction.
Very good. Yeah, because I know what you do is you rationalize those failures and you somehow pretty much talk your way out of them and see what you need to do. But sometimes there are some absolute criteria. This thing should not be continued. It failed. And the third one?
And the third one is, have a notion of where funding is coming from.
Mm.
Too many nonprofits get in a situation where they have to struggle just to find the funding to pay their staff. That means that executive staff focuses on fundraising rather than implementing programs. and staff aren't paid well enough, which makes it hard to attract really talented people. And knowing where that funding is going to come from is essential to running an effective organization.
Well, Ellie Hassenfeld, the co-founder and executive director of GiveWell, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Tell us more about your website and how you would suggest listeners go about navigating it.
Our website is at www.givewell.org. On our website, you can see our top charities list, and you can easily donate to any of the organizations. And you can also click through, as I said before, for all of the underlying information, footnotes, papers, and spreadsheets that support those recommendations.
It's all there. Well, thanks, Ellie. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
And that is this week's show. My guest next week will be Dan Weiss, the president and CEO of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. So you want to be here for that. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. And do return next Sunday evening for the Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of the Business of Giving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.